Tonight on Arena, Eero Leonard on his performance at Festival of Voice at the National Concert Hall, and Luke Murphy brings crime drama and dance together in Scorched Earth. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can watch us on rte.ie/arena. The inaugural Festival of Voice is a weekend event celebrating the power, beauty and universality of the human voice, showcasing some of our finest vocal talent alongside international artists. The festival will take place at the National Concert Hall and throughout Dublin City, in fact, from the 27th through until the 29th of June. There'll be a mix of main stage concerts, intimate performances, pop-up events and interactive workshops. On Saturday, the 28th, Shannos Master Eero O'Linard will perform some of, I suppose, this country's most ancient songs alongside soprano Emer Quinn and Tolu McKay, bringing the audience on a journey of Irish song accompanied by the National Symphony Orchestra under the baton of conductor David Brophy. And delighted that Eero is with me in studio this evening. I think these songs and David Brophy, who is, he's the artistic director, I think is the correct title for this overall weekend. He's certainly curating it, if we use that word, Eero. I think you had worked with David previously on this set of arrangements by a lot of them contemporary composers of the Shannos song. It must have been a festival, or that must have been a project that worked really well for you.
Well, it was. It's some years ago now, but I always imagined that maybe these songs could exist in kind of a new context. Mm. Because, of course, one of the great strengths of Irish song is the melodic kind of contour of our music. It's so beautiful. And I think the world over, people comment on how beautiful the melodies are. So some time ago, I did reach out to a lot of I suppose you could call them contemporary classical composers. They normally don't do arrangements, but I called in a few favours and this and that. And I managed to get some beautiful arrangements made, and some of them will feature in this concert.
Yeah, and among the composers whose arrangements will feature, Donacha Dennehy, of course, you've collaborated with Donacha and Crash Ensemble on more than one occasion, for sure. Dan Truman is in there as well. And Nico Muley, a man who has worked with Bjork, Anthony and the Johnsons, and the Metropolitan Opera House in New York.
That's right.
I mean, yeah, a very varied performance. I was interested in how he was speaking about this idea of when you go near these songs, you have to be very careful not to trample on them and to stand back and let the song sing.
Well, I suppose, in a way, I think sometimes people are too careful about that, especially when they're coming from the outside. They tend to, maybe there's a certain caution. I think Donacha Dennehy, for example, is very brave.
Yeah.
I suppose he's very familiar with my singing and with the tradition. Dan Truman also has done a lot of work in folk music, various folk musics, particularly Norwegian Hardanger and so forth. His work with Cleaving O'Reilly and many other things. He spent many months working on the arrangements, came to visit me in my house and really dug in very deep. Nico is so talented and is so naturally musical. I had no fear but that he would do something beautiful. And it has a sort of an American bigness to it, kind of that Panavision sort of feel that American composers often have.
Yeah, and when you think of that alongside Shannos, they seem like the opposites in some ways, because you think of the Shannos song, you think of the single voice, the single line, very little beat or meter carrying it along, purely that melodic line. It seems like a much more intimate affair than that, as you say, this Panavision type of aspect that you get.
And it is, you know, for the most part. And you mentioned something very interesting there, the thing about the time. Because, you know, Shannos singers, well, I speak for myself, I'm very bad on matters of time when it comes to singing in time or for time.
You're not counting 1, 2, 3, 4 as you're singing these songs.
I don't think I would be able to do it comfortably were it not for the fact that the wonderful David Brophy will be at the helm, and was when I first did these. Because he, of course, is very experienced in working with opera and this notion of bringing the orchestra along with the blind man on the galloping horse, who happens to be me. At the time. But, it, you know, I He's the master. I follow him with an open heart and with gladness. Yes.
I want to listen to some of the music, and we've spoken a bit about Nico Muley there. On Huildore is the song that he has arranged. Did you kind of match song to composer, or how did you go about that?
I did to some extent, yes. For example, the ones that Dan Truman are doing, he had a particular interest in my singing of those songs. Dunnock O'Denehy had used Tom Sheenter, the Huama, as part of the substrate, along with Aislinn Gall, for his now famous composition, Grog's Boss. Yeah. So he was very familiar with that one, but we hadn't actually given it wings on its own. And I thought of Nico, I did think of the scale of an Huildore, with its sort of, there's a feel in the melody, I think, that it is expansive and it is hovering over the landscape, and it's full of that sort of rhetorical grandiosity describing the beautiful Irish landscape of the 19th century. So I don't know. I think he did his own thing with it, but I think it's what I wanted.
Let's have a listen.
Is brand is a song near dawn. Me is Hunting
just as we were listening to that, Éire Ó-Linnar, that's a recording of An Huildore, an arrangement by Nico Muley. I think it's the RTE Concert Orchestra playing there. It'll be the National Symphony Orchestra that you'll be performing with as part of this Festival of a Voice. But we were saying, as we were listening to that little instrumental section, that's Aaron Copland. You know, it's those American composers that you're hearing, and suddenly the Shannon song and that beatless, meterless kind of quality fits perfectly into the open landscape.
I think so. I mean, even when I hear people like Keith Jarrett playing folk songs on piano, the Americans have a way of sort of opening it out into their own landscape, making sense of it in their own landscape, which is so beautiful and surprising. But then also it shows, I think, that our folk music is very adaptable, you know.
I want to, we were talking, what we were listening to, with great respect to Nico Muley, we were talking about Dan Truman and his arrangements. He does a version, which I have here, of, he arranged Shula Roon for you. You know, beautiful song, perhaps with a little bit more meter in it than many's the song. You can hear a little bit more of a beat in this. But I wonder, particularly for Dan Truman and Nico Muley, working with the Irish language, like Donnacha would have a knowledge at least, or at least have heard the language and have gone through it at school. How did they react to the linguistic aspect of these songs?
Well, Dan Truman is very invested in that kind of area.
Mm.
What does the language offer musically? And I've worked with him. I've done an opera with him. I've done these songs with him and other things. I worked with him in Princeton for about 4 years. We did a lot of stuff there. He's super invested to use an Americanism, in the sound of the language itself. And from the get-go, he was fascinated also with probably the hidden darknesses in this song. And I think he exposes and reveals a lot of interior emotional content in the song with these arrangements. That's one of the great advantages of working with an orchestra and with a great composer like Dan Truman, is that you find new and surprising avenues and information that you never thought the song contained.
I want to listen to a couple of sections, in fact, of this particular arrangement. It's a 7-minute version, and there's a huge big instrumental section about halfway through that I'll come to. But let's hear how it starts out and how we hear the very familiar strains of Shula Roon, the Dan Truman arrangement, Earl O'Leonard singing.
Oh, I wish I were on yonder hill. 'Tis there I'd set and cry my fill, and every tear would turn to rue. Scudet mavourneen.
So that's the opening section there of Shula Roon, Dan Truman's arrangement, which is one of the songs that Earl O'Leonard will be performing on the Saturday, the 20th of June, as part of the Festival of Voice at the National Concert Hall. And you were mentioning as we were listening to that to me, Earl, that Dan Truman, great exponent of the Hardanger violin, and he kind of tunes into that when in that arrangement. It's not that there's a Hardanger violin there. I don't think it's more that he's tuning into the idea of that instrument. What does that instrument do that the orchestra is emulating there?
Well, that instrument has one key feature, which is it has these sympathetic resonance strings underneath the normal strings. Mm. So if you tune the instrument in a certain way, you get this extraordinary aura lifting off the instrument.
Kind of adds body to the
exactly.
other notes in underneath it.
A kind of a shimmer.
Yeah.
And he found a way of doing that with the orchestra, and fair play to David Brophy. He really helped the orchestra, and they really rose to the occasion in tuning into this new aesthetic.
I want to move halfway into this particular arrangement, and it moves, the voice stops for quite a period of time, and in underneath you hear this long violin, but it's what he then does with the brass instruments that I find so exciting. I'm just taking the sound down underneath me there. And as you were saying, again, as we're listening to that earlier, you're mentioning Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And those brass notes, not that he's not copying John Williams or anything like that, but those brass notes going around underneath is he exploring the melody of Shula Roon? Is that what he's playing with there?
Well, I'm not entirely sure, but I do know that it creates this incredible tension.
Mm.
And then later on in that section, the whole sound sort of funnels down into a hole into the ground, yeah, and then suddenly bang up again with the voice.
Yeah, well, I actually wanted to play that precise section, because it's that brass goes on for maybe a minute or two, mm-hmm, and then it comes back with a trumpet way off in the distance, and then it leads into the voice, as we'll hear.
Thank you.
That arrangement that we've just torn apart, but when you listen to the whole 7 minutes and 22 seconds of it, it sits together perfectly. And you were saying to me earlier as we were listening to that loneliness of the trumpet, you could hear all kinds of Americanisms within that, but it speaks directly to the theme of the song.
It does, because, you know, this is an old Elizabeth Cronin song, and it has roots in the fact that young Irishmen, many of them had to fight in wars in Europe with the advent of the penal laws. They had to get out of Ireland. And men at arms would have been in a very perilous position in Ireland during those decades. So that song is kind of set in that situation where the man is leaving. But Dan very much explores what happens to the woman's emotional world. And so it's quite a different excavation, really.
Yeah, and that loneliness of the trumpet. You can almost see that trumpet in a big, vast, open landscape playing by him or herself.
Or a battlefield,
yeah,
even.
Yeah. And the what would be around the one living thing. Tola McKay and Emer Quinn are also part of this. I suppose they'll be exploring some of their own material. I'm hoping Tola will she be doing her version, her great version of N16?
She is
N17
doing,
even.
She is doing N17.
Yeah.
And she's doing a Marvin Gaye song, the wonderful Mercy, Mercy Me, one of my favourite songs. Mm. She has done several songs here with the arranger Kathleen Flynn, and also with your own Gavin Murphy.
Oh, yes, of course. Yeah.
And Emer Quinn, of course, the extraordinary Emer Quinn, will be singing her Eurovision winning,
oh, yes, The Voice.
Winning
yes.
song. We haven't won too often no. since then. The Voice and a few other pieces. It's going to be amazing for me to be on stage with those artists, I must say. It's quite a privilege for me.
No, it'll be a wonderful evening. I'm sure the three of you, who knows, there may even be a little trio somewhere along the way if you find the time.
Mum's the word.
Oh, I'm not being told. All right, okay. Gormila Mahagath is fettling and Oth Irla.
Gormila Mahagath.
Irla Leonard. Oh, Leonard with us. And Irla, along with Tola McKay and Emer Quinn, accompanied by the National Symphony Orchestra, conducted by David Brophy, will be on the main stage at the National Concert Hall on June the 20th, all part of the inaugural Festival of Voice. Full information about this and all of the other events can be found on nch.ie. It is 130 years old, and you could say it is still as entertaining today as it was when it was debuted in 1895. A new production of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest will open at the Lyric Theatre in Belfast at the end of this month. It is, of course, a Victorian comedy of manners involving two love matches, double lives and a baby. I'm going to stay away from any acting in a handbag, as Lady Bracknell says. The play was a massive success for Oscar Wilde from its premiere, but it was also, unfortunately, his last play and marked the start of the legal woes which ultimately led to Wilde's tragic downfall. This production of The Importance of Being Earnest is being directed by Jimmy Fay, and delighted that Jimmy joins us on the line right now. Again, for a little quotation, Jimmy, the truth is rarely pure and never simple. With that in mind, what is it about Oscar Wilde? Because I was thinking about this play in particular today. It could have been written yesterday in both style and substance.
Absolutely. It's spot on, Sean. It feels ever current. There's something about the way he uses dialogue and the way he sparks his characters off each other that still feels fresh. He doesn't get too bogged down with story. He doesn't get too bogged down with logic. But what he keeps is a razor sharp dialogue all the time. And I do think what he's getting at is important. He comes at it in terms of a satire. Like, he's satirizing the greed that's at the core of the British Empire at that time and the whole thing about society. And he's really, you know, he's a very brave playwright. Hmm. You know, he's, you know, like a lot of comedians, a lot of comics, I mean, they're made to be like court jesters. But actually, he's reflecting society back at itself in a hugely entertaining and bizarre way. He's like the Monty Python of his time. And I think actually his comedy, and particularly the importance of being earnest. It's so contained within itself. It's such a perfect work of art that it has influenced everybody from Spike Milligan, you know, Monty Python, Farley Ted, whoever you want, and all getting at the same thing, which is actually undercutting these bureaucracy of life, you know, to a certain extent.
Well, you know, I was thinking about more recent things, even like something like Bridgerton and the patter dialogue that you get in a show like that. Even social media, you could argue, looking for that pithy remark.
Well, what he talks about, yeah, I mean, Lady Bracknell has an amazing quote in it, which is, "We live, I regret to say, in an age of surfaces." And that's exactly what we live in. We, you know, I'm constantly on my Instagram, people, Facebook and all this kind of stuff to project the life that we kind of want other people to see us having. And I think that, I mean, Wilde is onto that straight away. He knew whatever current season jacket or whatever dress or whatever hat was being worn was part of this, you know, facade of getting through life to a certain extent.
I mean, I don't know if you can just to remind people of, I mean, this idea of the importance of being earnest is such a great title, even. It's got so many meanings within it. But it is about a fella letting on that his name is Ernest, even though it's not Ernest. That's essentially what we're talking about here. He's trying to win the love of the young woman he has met.
He's trying to win. It's Jack, and he's trying to win the love of Gwendolyn Fairfax, who's the daughter of Lady Bracknell. And there's two things against him at the moment. One is he has a double life. He has a life in the country where he's Jack, okay, and he's in charge of a ward and stuff like that, and he's very straight-laced, and that's it. And then he goes to town, he meets his great friend Algernon, and they are going a riot. They're just great mates and do all the, you know, they go bumbering and stuff like that. Well, Algernon, you know, educates him in this. But the other thing he has against him as well is that Gwendolyn is obsessed with the name Ernest. She won't marry anybody called Jack or John or whatever else. So he has to somehow pretend or be, you know, that he is Ernest. Then Lady Bracknell discovers that they're engaged and she's totally against it until she knows he has a country house and then he has money and he might be very interesting. So she begins to examine him and she does this huge cross-examination of him that's very entertaining. And then eventually he reveals he was found in a handbag and he doesn't know who he was. Yeah. And that's the big thing. So the search of the play is about identity and it's about shifting identities and it's about discovering who you are. I think that's why the play works so well.
And even as you describe that plot, and you see the story, yes, of course, the story is important here, but it is a critique of the society in which they were all living, and it's as relevant today as it was 130 years ago. But it has the feeling of, you know, the screwball comedies and those patter comedies of Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, someone like Preston Sturges or all of those kind of great Hollywood writers of the time, or even like, I mean, Tina Fey's and stuff now, they must take him as an example because he's able to set up a situation and then make it work in the world that it's in. You know, you don't need too much information. You just need the wit and to understand the rules. And once you understand the rules, you go for it like that. Like Roddy Doyle, Paul Howard, these are people who also do that kind of comedy work as well. And it is fantastic. It works really well. And it's always, again, satirizing society and the people who watch it. It's that friction between creativity and fiction, you know, it works very well.
Does the play as written, I mean, because the type of dialogue that is there, it has to be delivered precisely as Wilde has written it. It's like any good comedy, the timing, the rhythm of the line is absolutely essential to the laugh. It's not it's not about some kind of deep inner motivation or anything. You say the line at this speed because that's why it will get the laugh. You say it there so that the other person will get the laugh on their next line. Does it leave room for the actor, for the director to kind of open the play up in some other way, or do you have to stick to those? It's not that they're rigid, but you have to stick to the rules of delivery.
Well, the one thing he did say, Oscar Wilde did say about the play, like there's a few things, but the one he said, it has to go off like a gunshot. Okay. So pace is important. And I think that is a real vital part because the beauty of rehearsals is you can try many different things. And I mean, the way I work is, I mean, we work organically, you work, you know, like intuitively, you know, with the actors that you have. And I have an amazing bunch of actors who are also physically really kind of, you know, brilliant as well. So you try different things out in rehearsal. And, you know, I don't think there is one way to do it. I've never seen a production of Oscar Wilde's The Importance of Being Earnest in the same way. People shift it. Directors, you know, bring different concepts to it, etc. My thing at the moment is like to try and make it as physically as interesting and as verbally precise as possible, you know, because I do think the dialogue's important. But I also think the slapstick that's contained within it, which I haven't seen much of. I mean, we've things going on with the cakes and stuff like that. That's really important. I'm trying to make more of the working class roles, you know, Merryman and Lane, you know, they have a little bit more to do in this production than maybe as usual. The butlers, yeah. And they're played by a wonderful actor, Neil Carey, who just has the best deadpan face of all time. And he's brought actually great sympathy to Lane. He's made him quite sad, but it still works. The melancholy works very, very well. So I think every production is different, and I think you approach it in as fresh ways you can. It's like what the Royal Court used to say, is like classic plays you work on as new plays like classic plays. And I think that's the point. Like years ago, I did a production of School for Scandal by Brinjey Sheridan. And it's the same thing. I mean, you're kind of thinking like, I mean, how can you bring something fresh to this? And actors are just so inventive. They're so brilliant. They just eat up the kind of dialogue that they're giving and something like this and make it work, you know, make it sing, you know. Yeah. So, like, I mean, you can do anything you want so long as you have brilliant actors. That's the most important thing.
And I guess the freshness is that it's happening on the stage in front of your very eyes. You know, it's not recorded. It's not kind of being presented to you in some kind of secondhand type of way. Given all of that, have you kept it within a Victorian setting? I mean, you could easily change the costumes and bring it into some modern setting if you wanted to, but how have you approached that side
like
of things?
For ages I was toying, like, well, oh God, somebody's going to, you know, we'll set it modern day, we'll do whatever. I mean, I've seen it set in the living room, I've seen it set on things. So what I coined a phrase just for the whole creative team to work on was Victorian psychedelia. So basically to really push the surrealism as much as possible, because the 1890s is such a fascinating time. It's just towards the end of Victoria and the kind of darkness, because she was a widow for so long. Everything was quite dark and it was beginning to spark out into different lights and stuff. You know, you had different, like, I mean, you had the French music, Debussy and stuff like that. They were just coming in to kind of like give different trills. Satie was, you know, recording his stuff. There was all of these things that were going on. You had Gilbert and Sullivan, you know, like, I mean, all the fun, the fair kind of thing that was working really well. So the 1890s to me was a really vibrant and interesting age. And I think Wilde was at his zenith. And what was the tragic was how he was just taken down after this. It was just, it was awful. Because actually, had he lived, he was a very young man, I think he would have gone on and written for the Abbey, for Yeats's Theatre and stuff, you know, at the time. And we're just kind of robbed of that, because I think he was just at that moment blossoming into something extraordinary. And I think he had more great plays in him.
How quickly after during and after the opening night and the success of The Importance of Being Earnest, how quickly after that did the problems with Bosie, the legal wrangles with the Marquess of Queensberry, Bosie's dad, how quickly did that start to kick in?
Well, what happened is Bosie's dad, the Marquess of Queensberry, arrived at the opening night with a bouquet of vegetables and cauliflower and turnips and stuff like that to present to Oscar Wilde, and couldn't get access to the theatre. Left, you know, was kept out by the police, ironically enough. Then he went off to Oscar Wilde's club and left a card calling him for the sodomite Oscar Wilde. Where Oscar was silly was to then take umbrage to this and then to bring the Queensberry to trial for slander, which he shouldn't have done, okay? And Queensberry had one ace up his sleeve, which was Edward Carson. Edward Carson was the defence for Queensberry and basically put Oscar Wilde in the prosecute him for being gay, for taking up with Bosie's son. And the rules against homosexuality had only come in 87 or something like that. So it was quite a recent thing. So it was a big trial that then was, Oscar Wilde became the pinup for it. It was just horrendous what happened to him. And then he was scorned by society after that. He was put on trial and thrown in jail. It was terrible.
Yeah. And in terms of the writing, this was the last play, you know, and there's a huge subversiveness within everything, I think, that Wilde does. But did the writing just dwindle away into a different place after this moment?
Well, he wrote one profound thing, Der Perfumist, afterwards. Like, he had started as a poet and he, in a way, ended as a poet. And I think that's why his dialogue is so good. I mean, I'm not sure his early poems are great, okay, but I think his use of language and his knowledge of the way to use words and stuff was exceptional. And actually, to end with, the funeral is, you know, love not there, not speak its name, etc. It was just extraordinary. However, I mean, if you read like Frank Harris's biography, and there's lots of great biographies, but Frank Harris is the most contemporary. They had kind of, they commissioned him to write more plays, and he just didn't. He hadn't, he kind of spent the money, but he just didn't have it in him, you know, after jail. He was sort of destroyed, and he died only like 4 years later, you know. It's like, I mean, he was at the top, he was at the peak of London, and that means British, and that means world society. In 1895, you know, in February, and then he was completely destroyed and died in Paris. And the strange thing about the importance of being earnest is it prefigures all of that in the play. I mean, in the play itself, you got double lives, you got unpopular dads, you got impure cubes, you got shameful debts, you got Scotland Yard, and you also have the main character, Ernest, dies in Paris in the fictional world.
Yeah,
it's crazy.
Yeah, that it almost predicts what
happened to him, almost,
I was kind of surprised, however, that this was, it's your first importance of being earnest, first time to direct it. Is it your first time to direct Wilde? You mentioned Sheridan earlier on.
It is my first time to direct an Oscar Wilde. But actually, the strange thing about Oscar Wilde, I think for my life, he's always been there. If you think about it, when we're kids, The Happy Prince, you know, The Remarkable Rocket, The Selfish Giant, they were huge, you know, huge things to me. I liked his short stories, Lord Sackville's Crime. I think I had wanted to adapt that for years into a film, actually. And then I tried to do Ernest a couple of times, but
you were beaten to it by somebody else.
They're more brilliant, like Colin Morrison did a fantastic all-male version at the Abbey in 2005. And I just felt like you need to give these things like a decade in between, you know? And then when I came to the Lyric first, which was about 10, 11 years ago, it had just happened, you know, there had been a production of it just before. So I just had to wait, you know? But it is something I've always wanted to go for. And like, I figured, like, I mean, we've just done an amazing... I have an amazing team here, you know, we have a fantastic scenic workshop. So I kind of knew that we would be able to kind of really go with the design, and we've just been able to work really hard on making this kind of play, like, you know, well, it hasn't opened yet. Hopefully as good as it can possibly be within what we have.
A big tick off the bucket list then, I'm guessing.
Well,
let's not put you in the bucket list category just yet, however.
Well, no, I think there's a few directors at bucket list. I mean, you do have plays that might get you through life. I mean, because I love doing new writing, and we have some great new writing. Recently, we had Nancy Harris's play on that we produced, Our New Girl, which had, I think, it'd been in the gate for about a week, and then COVID closed it down, so we gave it a 4 or 5 week run, and it was terrific. And then I got John Morton's The New Month, which is a fantastic new play, kind of at the end of the world, which has Anna Healy and Paddy O'Kane in it, which will be on for the Belfast Festival. And then that's a new play that comes on. So it's great to do a classic play every now and again. It's just, it tests you in a different way. You know, like, I mean, you're still kind of doing dramaturg on it. Like, there was lots, there was a four act version of The Importance of Being Earnest. And we just needed it had been produced as a three act play. But there was great things in the fourth act, and it's just some of those lines I stole and put back into the
three
act. And it's great. It's working really well. It really is. We just come from a run, and it felt great, you know?
Well, listen, I hope it goes very well for you, Jimmy. Great as always to speak with you.
Sean, thanks so much for this. Thank you.
That's Jimmy Fay, and The Importance of Being Earnest opens in the Lyric Theatre in Belfast from on Saturday the 31st of May. It runs through until the 6th of July, and you'll find out full information on lyrictheatre.co.uk. Choreographer and performer Luke Murphy is known for his bold, boundary-pushing work that blends dance, theatre and visual storytelling. His latest piece, Scorched Earth, is his biggest production to date. A dance theatre thriller inspired in part by John B. Keane's classic play The Field, set in a stark interrogation room and rooted in Ireland's complex relationship with land and legacy. Features an international cast and a mix of movement, text and sound. It will open at the Abbey Theatre this Friday as part of Dublin Dance Festival, and will also be part of the Galway International Arts Festival later in the summer. Delighted that Luke Murphy is with me in studio this evening. And this all started with a stroll one afternoon with your dad, I believe, Luke?
It did, yeah. We were in the north side of the peninsula, the Sheep's Head out in West Cork, and we were kind of walking along, and he just pointed to this small patch of land on a really, really steep incline right by the sea, and everything around it was you know, overgrown was what the land there naturally does, which is it's basically just rock with a small bit of earth and gorse over it. And this is absolutely beautiful patch of land.
Pristine just, field. And
green
grass.
Like really amazing. Like the kind of the labor of love kind of popping out of it. And he said at the time, he said that really reminded him of the field. And I wasn't actually familiar with it back then so well outside of seeing the film as a small kid. So that kind of made me think about the image. And then that became a conversation about land and everything with him. And then things just kind of, the Pandora's box kind of opened from there.
So I suppose the idea of land and how important it is within Irish culture for a million and one reasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, when you're making anything, the first place you start is what's your relationship to what you're curious about. And even in myself, when I kind of hit that age where everyone around you and everyone else of your age kind of feels like they're supposed to start buying things, you should be buying a house, you know, you should be thinking about buying a house now. And you kind of feel that pressure, and then you understand in yourself, like, what it is that, why do you want to have something? And I'd noticed, because I've lived abroad for so long and I've spent so much of my life not in Ireland, that I had a much stronger feeling about like what was mine and what was mine and what wasn't than a lot of the people around me. And when I came back to Ireland, you know, you just started seeing that in different forms. You know, when I first moved back to Cork, I was living in a house in Cork, and my neighbor painted their house, and they kind of painted past the gutter, you know,
gutter,
you know, and it's so meaningless in one way. Yeah. And at the same time, you notice,
could argue that they were doing you a favor to keep it look well.
It was a much nicer shade of paint than I was using. Yeah. But, or seeing like a really heated argument between two neighbors about the unspoken etiquette of a car parking space in front of their houses or something like that, you know? So you kind of see the different forms it takes. Or, you know, you planted your hedge on what used to be my side of when there was a fence. Actually, the fence was here, and now you've planted hedges as a boundary instead of a fence, but you actually planted them on this side of where the fence used to be. And, you know, so there's these kind of really small forms that this kind of tension takes. And then there's the really big forms that the tension takes. And I feel it in myself, and I also feel like you see it around you everywhere, in extreme and in really small ways.
I mentioned it in the promo that I was recording yesterday for today, to go out on air during the day today. I mentioned this idea that you're mixing crime drama and dance. So, and I think this show started with a text that will be spoken in the way a play would be spoken.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's I guess what I'm interested in doing is kind of is sitting somewhere between a play and a dance show, you know.
Something you've always been doing, really, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And leaning further into it, I think probably the older I get and the more confident I get in what I'm really, you know, you start going, okay, you cut everything else out and you just go after what you're really interested in doing, the more further into your career I get, really. And so I'm leaning in, and I'm leaning in. So, and the more I do that, with this show, it felt like telling a story was very important. So figuring out what that story was and the best way of telling that was kind of the first thing. And then alongside that, you know, I think very visually, I think in terms of images. So then that and movement and action, they all kind of wind their way into it. But we're leaning into genre for sure. Someone saw a preview the other day and they said it's like an Irish Scandi noir. So if we're hitting that properly, then that should work.
That was the area that you were going for. So we have the text, we have the dance. Those are not the only two elements involved in this show.
Yeah, there's a bit of video in there. There's a series of projected images by an artist called Patricio Cassanoni, who's done absolutely mammoth work. And then there's a really beautiful set by Alison Cummins, and I work very closely with both my lighting designer Stephen Dodge and the composer Rob Maloney. I've basically kind of joined at the hip with them since we did Volcano together.
Yeah, so. And Rob Maloney's music, I'll play a little bit of it in a moment. But you do, it's not that you write the text, you do the movement, and then you add all these elements in after the event. These were in the rehearsal room with you, developing alongside as you rehearsed.
Yeah.
So people could really react to the reality of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, like, you know, from speaking to you before, up until a couple of years ago, I did everything myself. So I did all of my own sets and costumes and music and everything. And when I'm very glad to not be doing that now.
Had to let go of the control.
Yeah, exactly. It's mine. But, you know, I'm very glad to not be doing that now. But that means that I'm very used to actually everything kind of growing from the ground up together. Yeah. So now there's more people involved, but it still is everything kind of organically comes in and everything
I suppose
kind of grows.
In a traditional production, you'd have the text would be explored, and then all of those effects and the visual effect would be put in the last week of when rehearsals were done, technically trying all of these things out. But you have it there from the very beginning. Let's have a little listen to part of Rob Maloney's score for the piece. Kind of sinister sound as we listen to, and maybe we'll have a listen to a little bit of it, and you can talk to me about the kind of atmosphere that you wanted to create here.
Sure.
Just take that down and let it play underneath us. I was saying it's so atmospheric, and it is like the beginning of a Scandi noir film. Yeah. We're talking about Luke Murphy and the new show Scorched Earth. So this is over the opening scene. What are we looking at as this music is playing in front of us?
So as the show opens, I'll try not to give away too much now, but. As the show opens, a series of slides play out on this slide projector. And we start to kind of see a series of pictures from a crime scene and excerpts from an imaginary government commissioned report. And in the world of our show, there's been a report commissioned called the Green Report, which is looking into the pattern of land-based crimes in Ireland. And in response to that report, an investigator has been appointed to kind of look into historical crimes that weren't fully investigated. So we're learning that's the setup as this music is kind of coming in.
And it's so atmospheric. It really is so atmospheric in the way that it plays out. But it strikes me that, you know, what you're describing that we're looking at on screen or on stage rather, projections up at the back, slides, music playing there with us, and indeed text that will come in later on. It's a kind of whole theatre. You can't call it dance. You can't call it a play. There's a whole bundle of things going on.
Yeah. It's a mammoth of a show, and you know, as a piece of choreography, it's certainly the most worked piece of choreography when the movement is there, and it's the most worked scripts I've ever, you know, I've just kind of thrown the kitchen sink at it in with my energy and my attention. So, so I hope it comes together now, because it's certainly not for lack of trying, you know.
Yeah, well, I suppose you're at a point now where, well, you've done a couple of previews at this you're kind of waiting to see what's the full reaction going to be when we tidy up the loose ends, because they're always things that will change slightly during the preview period. I was interested, however, this idea of the land and the strength that it holds, or the place that it holds in Irish culture. Two things that I wanted to ask you about that. First of all, you have a cast here of not everybody's from Ireland, the team, not everybody's from Ireland. What was the attitude of other cultures within the cast and within the crew and the design and the production team? Did you find very different attitudes to land and the ownership of land?
Yes and no. I mean, one of the parts of the show that's kind of investigated a little bit is the idea of who's in and who's out, and who feels like an insider and who doesn't. And an interesting part of the cast is that, say, one of the performers in the cast is an Irish woman who's lived in England since she was very young. So she is a quite a strong English accent, but she's actually Irish. And that's kind of used in the show, as well as the idea that depending on how someone sounds, their identity isn't strong enough because they don't sound right, but she's actually Irish. And, you know, someone else who is really, their family is from Ireland. They have an Irish passport. They have like a huge amount of family from Ireland, but they are English. And so the first off is an international cast who actually, it's like what Irish identity is also inside the group of people who are working on it, especially at a time where, you know, I think what the idea of any national identity is kind of being asked to flex in really interesting ways at the moment, and rightly so. So that's also permeated throughout the people who are making this show, and that's kind of become part of the voice of what the show's about.
And the other aspect of it is, I mean, given that while it's not directly land, but you did talk about this idea, you reach a certain age and people are saying, well, you should be getting a house now and you should be doing this and that and the other. Now, clearly we have a huge housing and accommodation crisis in this country at the moment. Has that informed the text and the story that you're telling in any way?
Yeah, like what we take the show, it takes place a little bit outside of time. So we're not saying in the show this is happening in 2025 with a housing crisis going on. You know, we're not putting it inside that context. But the fact of the matter is that the show's being presented while that's going on. So everything that is relevant to what we're talking about, everything that's relevant about the cost of what you do to take what you think of yours, which is very relevant on an international stage right now, that's all present, but we're telling a very specific story at the same time, you know. But even the idea, you know, this statement that was like running around media for a while about, you know, we've been turned into a nation of renters as opposed to a nation of owners. That's a very Irish sentence, you know, because there's a lot of countries where that's not such an insulting thing to have happened. Like, that there's a lot of countries where actually renting is just a fundamental part of the culture, and it's not attached to this emotional sense of being robbed of something. So
interesting to explore, but I guess even now being a nation of rent, even to be a renter is quite,
you're doing
the task.
Well, oh man, tell me about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it is quite the crisis. Luke, best of luck with it all. I hope that it goes well for you and that you're happy with the outcome.
Thanks very
much. Sounds as if you're on top of everything from the way you've just described it to me. So best of luck, Luke Murphy there. Scorched Earth is at the Abbey Theatre as part of the Dublin Dance Festival. That's on Friday, May the 23rd and Saturday, May the 24th. And then it will be at the Black Box as part of the Galway International Arts Festival. That's from Tuesday, July the 15th through until Saturday, July the 19th. You can find out full details of the first performance on dublindancefestival.ie. Tomorrow night we'll be talking to Vono Grork about her new poetry collection, Infinity Pool. Brian McGilloway, Whet Her Appetite for the One You Least Suspect, his latest novel, but that is our lot for this Tuesday evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound, and this evening's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the 8 o'clock news.